I don't like to give advice. Okay, if I had to give some advice, I'd just say that, like, you just have to work really hard at whatever you do. I think that, you know, a lot of people do the bare minimum and they think that's good, and they don't, you know, brush off the edges and make sure everything's perfect and then strive for perfection. I think even if you just try to do that, that you wind up being doing better work than like 85-90% of the people. And it's like, it's pretty easy, but you have to actually like try and be motivated to do that, because most people just aren't. Most people are going to come in at 10:30 and leave at 5:30 or whatever the hours are. I mean, that's something that I learned at a very young age from my early work experiences, non-software, non-company experiences. It's something that I've carried with me throughout my professional life. This is my fourth job, so I'm 26. My first job I got when I was 14, I was a caddy on a golf course. So, you know, the guys that carry the bags and do all that stuff, and they're like the assistant to the golfer. I did that for 8 years. When I started, I knew nothing about golf. I had a guy ask me to give him his 5 wood, and I gave him his 5 iron. Like, literally knew nothing. By my third or fourth year, I knew all the rules. I was helping people with what the rules were in tournaments. I was giving advice to people. You know, the head pro there said I was one of the best caddies there. And there were people that had been there for 30 years, right? And what distinguished me was that I would just work harder. I would do more. I would work more hours. I would do more rounds than anyone else. So it wasn't necessarily that I knew more or that I was more capable. I was just more willing to work hard, right? And that showed, it reflected in my pay and the respect that I got in that job. And, you know, I had people even directly tell me that the key to success was to work harder than everyone else. So that's the only advice that I've ever been given, that was one of the few times where you're like, okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the guy who said it to me was also like, made his first $1 million at 22. He played golf every morning. He owned like 4 commercial buildings in New York, probably worth over $100 million altogether. So it was a guy, it wasn't like a Uncle Pete type of thing. Like, you just gotta work hard, kids. You know, like, this is a guy who like did it. And he like became very successful to the point where he could do whatever he wanted. He was like probably 65 or so when he gave me that advice. Died of cancer a couple of years later, which is sad, but that kind of thing always stuck with me. I always knew I was going to do software. I was coding at a very young age, like 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there. Like, I might have written my first line of code at 11 and then really started when I was 12 or 13. I remember, you know, I got into it because I was curious about the computer. And, you know, I had like gone through the whole user interface, all the settings. I had learned how to use the computer with just a keyboard, with just a mouse. You know, it was very much an exploration. And it got to the point where the things that I wanted to do, I could no longer do by pointing and clicking. So the only way to achieve those things was by writing code. Like, a lot of people, I think now they sit down and they're like, I want to learn how to write websites or make apps or do that. And for me, it was never about that. For me, it was like, I want to achieve this goal, and the only means for me to do it is to learn how to write this software. So learning to code wasn't an end in and of itself. It was a means to achieving some sort of goal, which I think is a subtle but big difference. I remember in middle school, they asked you to choose a field. They wanted you to research a field and choose like a career path for yourself. It was like a middle school exercise thing. And I remember looking at software engineers because I was doing it already and I was interested in it. It had like the best amenities, one of the best, highest ranking pays. Just like everything was like trending the right way. And it was like, well, that probably just makes sense for me to do this then. You know, it was just like, okay, this is kind of a no-brainer. Like, I'm good at this. I like this. I'm already doing it for fun. And it pays well, and there's big opportunities on the horizon, and the people that do it, you know, have good amenities and stuff. Like, you see what BetaWorks is like, right? Yeah. Bottomless seltzers and whatever, and, like, food and all that stuff. So, flexible work schedules, wear a t-shirt to work every day. You know, like, those things are pretty great, and you don't get them. I think we all take for granted that in most industries you don't get that. So yeah, and then, you know, I took programming classes in high school, I did computer science in college, and I was caddying this whole time because that was a way for me to make a lot of money very quickly. It was all cash off the books. I made like a lot of cash as a kid, like more cash than I knew what to do with. When I was 14, I had like $6,000 in cash in my house, and it was like a huge stack of 20s and a couple hundreds on the outside. And my mom saw it, and she was like, I think you have to go open a bank account, you know, because like you can't have this in the house. Like if the house burns down, you just lost your whole summer's worth of money. So yeah, I was caddying through all that, and then there came a point where I was offered an internship. And I sort of had like this dilemma because I was making so much money caddying. Like I was making like, I don't know, $6,000 a month, $7,000 a month.
What were you doing? Were you buying cars?
No, I bought my first car. I was saving money. I put money in the stock market. I'm like pretty conservative.
Diversified.
Yeah, pretty conservative. And like, you know, bought beer and hung out with my friends and paid for guitar lessons and bought CDs and, you know, bought guitars and all sorts of stuff. I just did whatever I wanted. It was just like my money. I managed it.
Were other kids doing the same thing?
My friends were because I told them about it, and they saw how much money I was making, and they were like, this is crazy. Like, caddying is like the best job ever. It's seriously, especially at that age, like, there were the kids that were bagging groceries for $7 an hour, and I was doing like $200 for 4 hours. So I was getting paid like $50 an hour. I mean, it's like crazy. The catch is, you know, I grew up in Jersey, so you could only do it 6 months. Not even 6 months, 4 or 5 months tops. And you can maybe do only one or two groups. You can only do one or two groups a day tops. So, and there is some time, they're like, you know, you would wait sometimes and not get a group. You'd go in some days and not get a group. You don't get paid when that happens. You know, so like there were drawbacks.
But I still want to become a caddy now.
Yeah, but it was amazing high school and college gig. And there was a point where I got offered an internship. I remember speaking to this guy, he's also very successful, but second generation money. But successful himself as well. And I told him there was this dilemma. Like, I got offered this software internship, and, you know, I didn't even apply for it. Like, the guy reached out to me. And it was probably a good opportunity for me, but I was making so much money caddying. And the guy was like, look, man, you don't want to be a caddy for the rest of your life. Like, this is a dead-end job where you're just going to be, like, you're going to cripple your body, and it's going to be terrible. And, like, you're not going to make, like, this is what you need to do. So what I negotiated for my first internship was to work 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m., pull 40-hour week. That way I could caddy Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So I worked 7 days a week, and I did that. That was the summer of 2009. So it was sophomore to my junior year. And then I continued working at that company while I was in school. So I was taking 21 credits a semester, so I was taking 7 classes, and I was working 20 hours a week at that company.
So you didn't sleep?
No, I managed it fine. I did my homework on the weekends. And yeah, a lot of, so I would take like 2 or 3 nighttime classes that were like from 6 to 9 or 6 to 8:30 once a week. It's like a really easy way to rack up credits. And then I'd have these huge blocks during the day where I could go and work. So, you know, I mean, it wasn't even that crazy. Like, I would sleep until 10, I'd wake up, I'd go to work, I'd work until 5:30, and then I'd go to class at 6. So give the stars to the lonely city, give the ocean to the country, ain't seen anything so pretty as a girl. I was lower middle class too, divorced parents. My father didn't really make a lot of money. He was on disability. My mother worked very hard, and she was like basically a secretary, executive administrator, or whatever they call it, NEA. And we didn't have a lot of money growing up. You know, I grew up in a one bedroom with my mom. She slept on the futon. I'm the only child, so there was this thing where it's like, you know, I'm growing up. And we didn't have a lot of cash, so if I wanted to have a car when I was 17, it wasn't like, you know, dad's going to buy you a Porsche, you know, which, like, I grew up in an area where that happened a lot. Mm-hmm. Bergen County is, like, one of the wealthiest counties in New Jersey, and New Jersey is, like, pretty wealthy per capita state. So if I wanted a car, I had to work to get a car. That's part of the motivation for caddying. If I wanted to go to college, I needed to get a scholarship because otherwise it was going to be crazy. Like, my mom was literally like, in middle school, I screwed around a lot. My mom was basically like, in high school, she let me do whatever too. My mom was awesome. But when I got to high school, she's like, look, I know in middle school you didn't apply yourself and that's fine. But like, if you want to get to college, you need to get a scholarship because we can't afford to send you to college. So you need to get good grades and then straight A's. And then, like, so my freshman year, I wasn't in honors because you need to do well in middle school to get into freshman honors. But then sophomore, junior, senior, AP tests, like, the whole thing. I was, like, model student. Growing up, and there's this idea of, like, okay, my parents don't have a retirement, really. Mm-hmm. Like, they may have some money in a 401k. You know, they got the mortgage on the house. Who's going to take care of them? Like, you know, my mom's 62, 63, and, like, in 10 years, 15 years, she's not going to be able to work. Like, what's going to happen? And who's going to do that? So, like, that's probably part of the motivation for me. It's, like, I need to make a lot of cash so that I can take care of my family. And then that's not even, like, counting, like, having kids maybe eventually, which is, like, something I want to do. I'm also, like, the last of my name. So, like, my father was very adamant about me passing on the family name and having a son. So that's always been a long-term life goal. I don't know. Those things I think about. Rare hearts that never disagree. I mean, most of the people I know, let's say the people I went to high school with, they're all very comfortable. Their parents, like, middle to upper middle class. They're probably going to get an inheritance, you know, even maybe just, like, a house that's, you know, has the mortgage paid off, you know what I'm saying? Like, they're going to get something, they'll probably be fine. The parents probably have retirement funds. And a lot of them are pretty complacent as a result, it seemed. I don't know if the circumstances were switched for me, and I don't think that that's necessarily the case across the board. Like, there's very wealthy people that go on to do great things, and sometimes I think the wealth is necessary to do great things, to take the kind of risks you need. I mean, you look at Mark Zuckerberg, like, the guy grew up in Dobbs Ferry, right? His dad is a dentist, right? Like, it's, like, well-to-do. Dobbs Ferry is, like, a very nice area. And, you know, he's the kind of guy where he could drop out of Harvard and take his crazy risk on this company because if it fell apart, who cares? You know what I'm saying? Like, I did start a company, but, like, I kind of can't take that kind of risk. You know what I'm saying? Like, Evan Spiegel's another good example. His dad's a big shot LA lawyer, you know, right? I think they live, like, in Malibu or something, where they have a house in Malibu or something, right? And, you know, I mean, I think that if you you have a bigger appetite for risk when there's less to lose. There's less on the table, right? When you have this safety net and backdrop. And then you can really go out and, like, swing for the fences and go crazy. And that's great. Like, I'm not envious of those people at all. I'm really, the point I'm trying to illustrate is I don't think that you have to come from very meager means in order to have the motivation you need in order to work hard and be successful. Like, obviously, Mark Zuckerberg and Evan Spiegel worked very hard to get where they are, right? I think there are different motivations there.
In case this is just a dream, I let my tired eyes loose. Lord help me float downstream, sliding down the river of fools. So let
I don't know, like I started this company that was a pretty big failure. It was like location-based social networking in 2011. Echo is what it was called. So in 2011, the landscape is very different now. Like if you say location-based social networking, it's very dirty because like Foursquare is having problems or they're like still trying to go through this transition. A lot of that whole industry fell apart. But in 2011, there were a lot of venture capital dollars going into location-based social networking. There was a lot of buzz around it. People were using this really dumb acronym SOLOMO, Social Local Mobile, which again is another dirty word to use now and has very negative connotations attached to it. By the time that I started the company, it seemed like an interesting area. It seemed like, you know those Snapchat local stories? You ever like look through them? They're like pretty interesting, right? And that use case is something I think a lot of people were trying to capture. I think that you needed some other value proposition, right? Like the way like Snapchat started as a messaging application, and then they did the public broadcasting as the stories, and then they did location-based stories, right? So like all those are like stepping stones to the end. A lot of people, including myself, were using the location-based story idea or whatever as the end itself, but the individual's motivation wasn't necessarily there. And that was always the big challenge. Like, why would you use this location-based one? So I think that was like the ultimate failure, and also my incapability and lack of understanding around how to build local communities. I mean, that was like the whole thing. I had no idea how to do that. I built good software, but I had no idea how to foster a local community. Even fostering an online community is something I'm not really good at, and it's something that, you know, some of the companies here are starting to think about. So Dig is going to do an online community, and they're bringing in third-party people to help them that have built online communities, manage online communities, that know what's going to happen, that can help them through that, right? Now, taking that and doing it on a local scale is like a whole different skill set. I mean, you're talking about basically like community board type of stuff, right? And it's very hard to like penetrate those type of things and then do that on scale. Very, very difficult. So the basic concept was we were trying to do Twitter for locations. So the idea is that you'd open the app, it would detect which city or neighborhood you were in. So we're at BetaWorks in the Meatpacking District. It would detect you were in the Meatpacking District and then serve you all these like tweet looking things, basically tweets, but native to the platform for that location. And we indexed all of that content based on administrative zones. So Meatpacking District is in Manhattan, which is in New York City, which is in New York States, and there were feeds for each of those. So if you posted from the Meatpacking District, it would show up in the New York City feed, it would show up in the United States feed, it would show up in the Earth feed. And you could use that to kind of like drill down into other areas. So it was like, you know, there's like some good technology behind it. I had a database of like every city in the world and like this massive tree, right? Where like continents into countries into, you know, each country calls it something different, but you would call it administrative zone 3 or states or something. And then administrative zone 4 would be counties. What we would call counties, they call them different places. They call them different things everywhere. And then you'd have the cities at the end. So I had like this massive database of all that stuff and the ability to detect where you are and build that tree and index content on that tree. I still think it was interesting. I'm still very proud of the product we built. But it was like hard to get people to use it, or like why would they use this over Foursquare or whatever, because functionally for them it was the same because they were just posting stuff at a certain location and there was no big differentiation for the end user. But I like showed it to BetaWorks. I had built the whole thing myself. BetaWorks had tried something similar and learned a lot of the lessons that I didn't know about. And decided they were not going to pursue that again, but they basically gave me an open-ended job offer, which is how I came to BetaWorks. Your question was about lessons learned, and I needed that backstory a little bit to frame the context. So lessons learned, I just had like no idea what I was doing. I think it was like actually a very good experience. I made a lot of mistakes. The first version of the product was like totally atrocious. It was like trying to do way too many things. It was unclear what the users should be doing. The value proposition was very unclear. It was actually quite a different application than the one I just described. It was more check-in focused, and it was tough. It was tough. Like, even my friends were like, I don't get this at all. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So I think I learned a lot from like a product management and like understanding. I started to be able to put myself in the position of someone who's looking at something with fresh eyes, right? Like, very fresh eyes. So like you can look at something and be like, this is going to be confusing for another person because they're not going to understand this, and we need to make this simpler, or we need to explain what this is, or we need to do something in order to make this a cleaner, more seamless experience. I think that was a big thing learned. I think I learned that, you know, I mean, look, I lost a lot of people's money. I lost like $250,000 that didn't belong to me. I lost a lot of my own money, like a lot of the money I saved from caddying and stuff. Spent most of that just supporting myself. You know, I made mistakes managing people, managing capital. I made marketing mistakes. I made product mistakes. I made leadership mistakes.
If you had to go back in time?
I mean, if I could go back in time, maybe I would have done something different. Like, maybe I would still start a company, but maybe I have so much benefit of retrospection now. So it's 2015. I started the company 4 years ago when I was 22. Like, fresh out of college, and I was just like, all right, well, if I'm going to take a risk, now is probably the right time because, like, I have money in the bank and I don't have a lot to lose. I lost the money, but whatever. If I could go back, I wouldn't have taken anyone else's capital, which would have made things harder. I wouldn't have hired a designer. I would have just contracted on an as-needed basis. I think that was a mistake. Yeah, I mean, as soon as you take someone's money, it's like you're beholden to them, and they become your boss. You report to them. And if you lose it, you just feel terrible because, you know, like, hopefully you care about those people, the ones that gave you the money, the ones that, like, took the shot on you. And you know, to have that call with them and be like, hey, we're out of cash. We can't raise more cash. This thing is not working. I don't know how to fix it. That sucks. And that was like one of the worst feelings I've ever had in my life. Thankfully, there, you know, the people that invested were very understanding, and you know, I think had my best interest in mind, and were very supportive about me moving on and finding a job and coming to BetaWorks or doing whatever. But that sucked. So if I could go back, I would have made Tinder or Snapchat or Uber or something else.